Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So outside of the stupid stuff we're hearing from, say the governor of South Dakota about how there's so much in that infrastructure plan, like pipes and housing, that aren't infrastructure, which is just hysterical. It's now evidently, according to a Republican memo that's going around, it's now Joe Biden's slush fund. You know, because we've neglected our infrastructure for 30 years now. It's a slush fund instead of, hey, we really do need to get stuff done. They also said that it's a partisan plan to kill jobs. Yeah, except it's going to create millions of jobs. And here to share some thoughts on the Biden Build Back Better infrastructure plan, I've asked David Madlin to come talk with us. David is the strategic director of the American Worker Project there at the Center for American Progress. He's also got a great book coming out, Reunion, How Bold Labor Can Reform, Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So it's a slush fund. It's not about the roads and bridges. It's not about getting decent broadband access into areas like where I live. It's not about widening our ports. Not about any of that stuff. Slush fund. Purely a slush fund. And a job killer.
That's probably one of the weakest arguments I've heard in a long, long time. Especially considering that If you believe that this is what Donald Trump wanted to do when he was president, that he kept claiming he was going to have an infrastructure plan, and never finally delivered. And now President Biden is really delivering a true infrastructure plan, which makes the kinds of investments that sadly this country has put off for decades and decades. And doing the kinds of roads, bridges, but also the more modern kinds of infrastructure investments, the pipes, but also green jobs and the like, is key for addressing the crises our country faces now, but also building a better economy in the future. Because a central plank of it, as you know, is not just about any jobs. These are good union jobs that they're trying to be created here.
And that, to me, I keep coming back to when I see these slush fund comments or anytime I see one of these folks, going on about, how this is, all special interest giveaways, immediately my mind goes how much the Republican Party dislikes union workers as by their policies, and how, look, those construction jobs, they are good wage jobs. Those are good union jobs, and they're good jobs because they are union jobs. And that this bill is going to do a lot to create more of those, which I want everyone to have a good union job. I want everyone to be able to support their families, have good health care, have retirement security. I think that's the least we should be aiming for.
It's essential to getting our economy going and getting the country back in the right direction. This is sadly partisan, as you're describing, but the public overwhelmingly supports these kind of things. The public wants investments in better roads and bridges, tunnels, in greening the economy, in clean water, in ports, in all of that, and they want them to be good jobs. So this is, we're in a really warped time where the investing in our future is now seen as a partisan kind of game, when it's clearly the right thing to do for the country, and it's clearly what the public wants. You can get into all the studies showing how far behind our infrastructure is in quality compared to most other advanced countries, or the other studies of a number of jobs to be created, or the future growth, you try to think about the interstate highways more than 50 years ago now when they were created, and the amount of economic growth because they reduce transaction costs and all these sort of core things that we are able to get out of infrastructure. And this is it's what's needed. And it's really sad we're in this warped time that's now a partisan game.
Yeah, but the other thing I'm waiting for, and we heard a little bit about it from the beginning, but we're really now starting here. We can't afford it. We're broke because we spent all this money during the pandemic. And in fact, one of the things that they were talking about is the fact that, we for the first 6 months, we've got a projected budget deficit of $1.7 trillion. So, I'm getting a bunch of people saying, well, but I guess debt doesn't matter anymore. And you go, these are investments that we've needed for decades. So how concerned are you that we're running up debt and our deficits are so high and we're running up debt on our national debt?
Well, there's, you know, a couple things to way to think about debt. So first, these are long-lasting investments that have long-term payoffs. And so going into debt for those kind of things in any situation is often a really good deal. Think of it like your house or long-term education. These have long-term payoffs, and they pay off far more than the initial cost of them. And so that's one way to think about it. But the other ways to think about it are sort of what's the, you know, how much is our debt servicing? And right now, interest rates are very, very low, historically low. So the cost of that debt is very low, while at the same time, the need is kind of as great as it's ever been. So we're likely to get a very high payoff, and the cost is likely smaller than in most other times. And then the last sort of, you know, more partisan and political kinds of elements to be thinking about are, we just, you know, a couple years ago had massive Trump tax cuts, largely for the wealthy, and those we didn't worry about, you know, people that are most worried about adding to the debt or deficit, you know, weren't particularly worried about those. And so now they find a political reason to be particularly worried, and especially because we can pay for a significant portion of the infrastructure plan by repealing those tax cuts, and that is causing their great concern that we don't want to pay for it that way. Actually, the only way we want to pay for anything is by cutting every other service to the bare minimum, so that, you know, our country is going to fail in another different way.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. You know, I often say I'm a tax and spend liberal. You know, if we need something, we need to raise the money to do it. And we've allowed the wealth class of this country to get away with not paying taxes for decades. It's time for them to pony up. We've got the largest, most prosperous billionaire class in the history of civilization. We've got needs. They've got money. Seems like a perfect opportunity to be moving in that direction. Now, one of the things that I was happy to see that Joe Biden included in his infrastructure plan was the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize Act, because as we've seen in Alabama, it is a long, arduous process for people to pursue their right to organize. And it comes with a lot of harassment, a lot of intimidation, and the fact you can't even go to the bathroom without being berated by anti-union messaging. For me, right now is the time where we need to be talking about changing our labor laws and reforming them. I'm curious your thoughts of one, do you think it's going to get through with the PRO Act, and what would something like the PRO Act do to help workers organize?
Yeah, the PRO Act is an absolutely key piece of legislation. You know, some of the details of it that we can talk a little bit about are, you know, one of the things it does is it increases the financial penalties for employers that cross the line and do things that are illegal, like, say, fire an employee for wanting to join a union, because right now there's no financial penalty for doing so, so much so that, you know, some employer, they have to post a notice, and we'll call that their hunting license. And it's key, I think, that the PRO Act is part, as Joe Biden sees this as part of his infrastructure plan. And that's because his plan for infrastructure is really about rebuilding a better economy than the one we currently have, building towards the future. And that means to him, and as it rightly should, good union jobs for the future. And the PRO Act is a central piece of that, because our laws right now, as you know, private sector union density is lower than it was before the National Labor Relations Act was passed. So before, basically, the law gave workers union rights. We're almost going back to when unions were thought of as a restraint on trade, and antitrust laws were, you know, like, we're going back really, really far to find union density, private sector union density, as low it is today, because our law makes it virtually impossible for workers to organize. You know, almost any organizing campaign that happens, they're going to start off, they wouldn't even undertake the effort unless they're starting off with what you know, 3/4 of the workers thinking they support it. But the way our law lets companies use all their power and influence to make it really hard on workers who want to join, so that then that 70% falls way, way, way down when the workers go, oh, I'm scared, this isn't worth it. So yeah, we need to change our laws, and the PRO Act is a key step to do that. It's, you know, you asked the last bit here is about its chances of passage. It did pass the House recently, 2 weeks ago, I think. And one of the notable things about it is it had a handful of Republicans support it. In today's day and age, that is remarkably bipartisan, sadly, and all universal support amongst the Democrats just about, and then a very small handful of Republicans. Now, of course, it goes to the Senate, where we need a supermajority because of the filibuster to pass anything, and that is a very high hurdle for any piece of legislation to achieve, and certainly something that, like the PRO Act, that would rebalance power in the economy, has a very stiff road with a filibuster. So we either need to change the filibuster or some other rule to allow a majority to pass things in the Senate for the PRO Act to have a chance.
Now, is there a way to go through budget reconciliation like they just did to include this in an infrastructure plan? Because it is monetary.
It could be. I think you're probably looking at a similar set of arguments to what the minimum wage. I don't know if you or your listeners sort of followed that debate that closely. It's sort of hard. The budget reconciliation rules, as they have been interpreted, are much more around tax issues and individual expenditures, even though lots of other policies like the minimum wage or the PRO Act have very significant budgetary impacts because, for example, workers are going to earn a whole lot more money and therefore pay a lot more taxes. And so there are a fair amount of people making those kind of arguments, but so far that hasn't been allowed. And therefore, and the budget reconciliation process is key because it allows 50 vote, process for things to happen in the Senate. But that doesn't seem likely as of now. Things certainly could change, but I don't think it's going to happen in the immediate future.
Now, even if you could get all 50 Democrats on board, you still have the two from Arizona and the guy from West Virginia to deal with, and Werner from Virginia as well. Those are problem places. Now, you've got a new book coming out. I want to talk a little bit about Reunion, how bold labor reforms can repair, revitalize, and reunite. And that's the interesting part that caught my attention. Reunite the United States. How would labor law reform reunite us, do you think?
Well, the things that unions do, if you have a much stronger labor movement, unions can do some more of the key things that they do. And so when they reduce any economic inequality in society, and that brings people more together in a bunch of ways. And one of the most significant things it tends to increase trust across society when you have a more equal society, and that enables people to work together. It reduces the extreme political polarization and the just assumption that someone else lives a very different life from you, and the idea that you can't sort of work with them. So it's a key step in this very broad set of reforms. It is very sort of broad societal change, but it's stronger unions also on their own. The very acts that they take, they bring workers together from diverse backgrounds, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, and have them work towards a common goal and negotiate on relatively equal footing with their employer to improve the conditions in their workplace. And that leads so that unions help reduce racial distrust. They really are a sort of unifying force for the workers involved. Not every time, not every place, but it is a key step forward for the kinds of steps that our country needs to take to repair the sort of great divides we currently have.
No, you're right. And to that point, I keep a contract of the contract that I've worked under for decades in the freight industry on my desk because it does all the things you said. It doesn't matter if you're white, black, Hispanic, male, female, gay, straight, doesn't matter any of that stuff. You do this job, you're compensated at this rate. These are your benefits. It's all down the line. In fact, I had a conversation about, transgender, workers, not too long ago. And I said, I knew someone, 30 years ago who was a transgender worker. He left as a former drill sergeant in the Marines during the Vietnam era, came back as a woman and, kept his job, kept her job, kept her seniority, kept her wages, and just went right back into work. It was what it was. We didn't need special commissions. We didn't need, you know, edicts from above. It's just people went back to work, and we dealt with it. And I think for me, this is why I think we do need to have a contract in every workplace, and people need to get used to that kind of stuff. Or just my thought.
No, I'm with you. The union contract is, you know, a key equalizer, and it's also oftentimes a sort of key pioneer in society for the basic equal treatment and equal value of all people doing work. And you know, you talk about benefits, you know, from paid leave, which is sort of key for lots of families to be able to have, or health benefits for partner and spousal partner benefits on sort of equal terms to the sort of health benefits that were just for married couples before. And so unions have a long tradition of ensuring that everyone's work and has value and equal value. And those are the kinds of steps we need in our country. And so that's where I get to the reuniting and restoring some of the core values and aspirations of our country here. But we have a long way to go. And that's another sort of central element of the book is not only the promise of unions, but obviously we have a long way to go to get there and what we need to do to strengthen the labor movement. And, you know, policies like the PRO Act are a key step forward because sort of policy needs, and I think we need to go beyond just even the PRO Act, beyond just the rights that the PRO Act creates. We need to actively put government on the side of encouraging workers joining unions, because unions really are a public good. They benefit all of society with higher wages, you know, lower inequality, less racial division. And the thing about public goods is you're going to get less of them than the sort of socially optimal, because there's always this incentive to free ride. And so you need to actively encourage it. You put your thumb on the scale and say, we think this is something we want as a society and we want more of. So we are going to have policy that really encourages people to join unions.
Yeah, good stuff. David, I appreciate the time. I hope folks will check out the book, Reunion, How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. We'll get links out on how folks can check that out. But David, I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate it.
Good stuff, David Madlin. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Thanks, David. Appreciate it.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.